Carolyn Forché's poetry brings to my mind E.M. Forster's vital dictum, only connect. It is an aesthetic charge and a moral one. The method of discovery and generation, the imperative that leads through the verbal richness of a poem and beyond it to an implicit vision of the world that makes of personal choice a political matter. Forché connects word to word deftly, chaining them into simile and metaphor the way, to use a simile of her own, Alfonso strings Chimayo's chilies like sacred hearts, tongues of fire tied together. Her words connect people, body and spirit, to place, where a woman walks in the body of a twisted bush, like mud hens, her hands. Sitting down to a genteel feast in a country rife with political violence and poverty, the poet suddenly connects. This is not Paella. This is what has become of those who remained in Buenos Aires. The connections reverberate beyond any verbal tour de force. Here is a beauty nourished by death, consumption, conspicuous, atrocious. Words are connected so that people may connect, and Forché's command of the grammar of relationship, herself with her audience, with the characters who inhabit or haunt her poems, dead and alive, kin, friends, lovers, and strangers, and with her own past and future selves, commands our attention. Many voices come through these poems. There is the internalized voice of her dead grandmother Anna saying simply, "I am trying to tell you something." Something of a Slovakia that is gone, perhaps, and something of a life yet to be chosen, to be lived. There is the voice of an old friend Joseph, slung on the wires that lapse, scalloping the cold length of the country between us. Words of Vietnam, of current life in the bullet factory, of life unexamined, to be examined. She hears him, but can he hear her? Connections can be difficult. Carolina, asked the voice of the Salvadoran poet Claribel Alegría, in another poem, do you know how long it takes for one voice to reach another? Forché knows. In San Onofre, California, where refugees disappear with the rough words, come with us, she listens and knows that the cries of those who vanish might take years to get here. Of the disinherited people of Tortugas, she says, your blood will surface when you hear these voices, this news, these people, their bells, your skin comes to touch this fire. When the connection is made, when the words do reach us, as in the poem Return, we are told it is not your right to feel powerless. Listen, only connect. The voices, as in the poem Ancapagari, sway within you. You are forever swinging between this being and another, one being and another. There is a word for it crawling in your mouth each night. Speak it. This is the choice the poet makes in message. I will live and living cry out until my voice is gone to its hollow of earth, where with our hands and by the lives we have chosen, we will dig deep into our deaths. As an investigator of America, a journalist in El Salvador, by the life she has chosen, Carolyn Forché has already dug deep. In her preface to Flowers from the Volcano, her translation of Claribel Alegría's poems, Forché notes that the poems are political in the sense that there is no life apart from our common destiny. Her own poems are political in this sense. From her first book, Gathering the Tribes, which won the Yale Series of Younger Poets Award in 1976, through the second, The Country Between Us, which won the Lamont Prize in 1981. The political force of the poems in this recent book, particularly those which portray vividly the horror and pathos of life in El Salvador, cannot be ignored. Yet at the same time, and this is primary to their power, the poems are intensely personal. The connections between the personal and political culminate in the terrifying consciousness of ourselves or nothing, the final poem in The Country Between Us. This poem is dedicated to Terence Dupré, another writer who, in his book about the Holocaust, The Survivor, is committed to hearing those voices of suffering which we may not want to hear but must. Forché's poem is passionately haunted by the awareness that these voices bring, by the apprehension of political atrocity and death, and by the fatality of our choices in a world where, despite our loving connections with each other, and this is importantly a love poem, all the mass graves of the centuries dead will open into your early waking hours. She concludes, there is a cyclone fence between ourselves and the slaughter, and behind it we hover in a calm, protected world like netted fish, exactly like netted fish. It is either the beginning or the end of the world, and the choice is ourselves or nothing. In considering this choice, we do well to listen to the voice of Carolyn Forché. Listen and only connect. Thank you for the lovely introduction. I would like to read tonight from the new book, The Country Between Us, and also two brief prose selections from a work in progress. I begin usually with a poem about adolescence growing up in rural Michigan. I grew up mostly among French Canadians, and this was in the period of the late 50s and early 60s when we were what was called at that time greasers, which meant that the women would backcomb their hair and then smooth it into a motorcycle helmet shape and spray it with hairspray so that it wouldn't move in the wind. And we wore white lipstick and black eye makeup and black clothes, and we thought we looked beautiful. And our mothers thought we looked embalmed and told us. My best friend was a woman named Victoria Champagne. And Victoria Champagne was more developed than I was. So she had more boyfriends than I did. But she advocated having boyfriends in military service. And she liked them because they appeared handsome in their uniforms. The Vietnam War was on at the time, but we didn't yet know to be against the war. And she liked also to be with them because they were never around. So one never had to do anything with them. And so she kept, so there are references in this poem that allude to that and that experience of that war. I went away to university. I was the only one in my among my friends to go. And that autumn, most of my friends were married, Victoria among them, but I don't know to whom, so I don't know what her name became. So this is a poem to find her again, as children together. Under the slope snow, pinned all winter with Christmas lights, we waited for your father to whittle the soap cakes away, finish the whiskey, your mother to carry her coffee from room to room, closing lights cubed in the snow at our feet. Holding each other's coat sleeves, we slid down the roads in our tight black dresses, past crystal swamps and the death face of each dark house. Over the golden ice of tobacco spit, the blue quiet of ponds, with town glowing behind the blind white hills and a scant snow ticking in the stars. You hummed Blanche comme la neige and spoke of Montreal, where a Québécoise could sing, take any man's face to her unfastened blouse and wake to wine on the bedside table. I always believed this, Victoria, that there might be a way to get out. You were ashamed of that house, its round tins of surplus flour, shipped beef and white beans, relief checks and winter trips that always ended in deer tied stiff to the car rack, the accordion breath of your uncles down from the north, and what you called the stupidity of the Michigan French. Your mirror grew ringed with photos of servicemen who had taken your breasts in their hands, the buttons of your blouses in their teeth, who had given you the silk tassels of their graduations, jackets embroidered with dragons from the Far East. You kept the corks that had fired from bottles over their beds, their letters with each city blackened, envelopes of hair from their shaved heads. I'm going to have it, you said. Flowers wrapped in paper from carts in Montreal. A plane lifting out of Detroit. A satin bed. A table cluttered with bottles of scent. So standing in a platter of ice outside a Catholic dance hall, you took their collars in your fine, chilled hands and lied your age to adulthood. I did not then have breasts of my own, nor any letters from boot camp. And when one of the men who had gathered around you
took my mouth to his own, there was nothing other than the dance hall music rising to the arms of iced trees. I don't know where you are now, Victoria. They say you have children, a trailer, tin in the snow near our town, and a husband you found as a girl, returned from the Far East, broken, cursing holy blood at the table, where nightly a pile of white shavings is paid from the edge of his knife. If you read this poem, write to me. I have been to Paris since we parted. Thank you. The next section of poems begins in California, goes to Spain, and then to Central America. The entire section is dedicated to the memory of Monsignor Oscar Romero, who was the Archbishop of San Salvador until his assassination on March 25, 1980. It also contains an epigraph by the poet Antonio Machado. This epigraph is from the lines of Machado's poetry, but it is also inscribed on Machado's own tombstone. The lines in Spanish are, Caminante, no hay camino, se hace camino al andar. In English, this is, Walker, there is no path. You make the path while you walk. In 1975, I was teaching English and writing at San Diego State University, and I lived very close to the border of Mexico, and we had a very nice life in the city that my students called a golf course with houses, and they attended a university that they called a cemetery with lights. And there's a little town north of San Diego, and if you drive to Los Angeles from San Diego, you take Highway 5 and you have to pass through this little town. It's called San Onofre. And when you're passing through San Onofre along Highway 5, you must slow your car down to 10 miles per hour so that you can pass between the booths across the highway of the U.S. Immigration Authority. And as you pass through, they wave you through like this and they look in your car to see if you look American. And if you don't, they motion you over and they ask for you to provide documentation, proof of citizenship. While you are slowing down, you can have a little tour of San Onofre. On your left, on the ocean side, are the twin igloos of the San Onofre nuclear reactor. These are on the beach, on the fault line. And on the right, on the coast up the cliff at the top, is the cyclone fence, which is the beginning of the San Clemente compound. You all remember what that was. It was once called the Western White House. So I thought this town needs a poem badly. So even though it's not about San Onofre, I titled it San Onofre, California, but it's really about ourselves anywhere in the extreme south of California. We have come far south. Beyond here, the oldest women shelling limas into black shawls. Portillo scratching his name on the walls, the slender ribbons of piss, children patting the mud. If we go on, we might stop in the street, in the very place where someone disappeared, and the words, come with us, we might hear them. If that happened, we would pass our lives with our hands tied together. That is why we feel it is enough to listen to the wind jostling lemons, to dogs ticking across the terraces, knowing that wild birds and warmer weather are forever moving north. The cries of those who vanish might take years to get here. I befriended a woman named Maya Flecol in California, and her mother was a Salvadoran woman poet whose poetry had never been translated into English. When I read the poetry, I felt that this was something that I wished to undertake. I had studied Spanish in college, and I sat down with a dictionary and I tried to do the translations, and I failed. And it was because I didn't understand the sensibility behind the poems. So the following summer, Maya invited me to accompany her to Spain to live with her mother for a summer And her mother would then help me to understand the poems. Her mother had been at that time in exile from Salvador for 23 years. She had written a book called Ashes of Izalco. The piece I'm going to read for you now is the beginning of a prose work that is in progress. The book is entitled Common Knowledge, and the book is an account or a memoir of the 6 years, beginning in Spain, the 2 years in El Salvador, and the time since. So it is an account of the political experience or the moral experience of an American. I'm going to read from the very beginning. What you will be hearing as I begin is the voice of Claribel Alegría. This is what I know. This much I can tell you. They lived in Buenos Aires all their lives. Her husband was a prominent journalist, one of the most respected. She had invited him to the home of her parents for after-dinner coffee. Only the two of them, and no one would have knowledge of it. They were very happy that night, reclaiming the abandon of their early years. Although taxis are difficult to find late in Buenos Aires, one pulled alongside them almost immediately. She was later to recall the high collar of the driver, buttoned despite the heat. And it was later theorized that he concealed a tiny communication device on his throat. They climbed in and gave the address of the parents' house. He repeated the address, as is customary, to verify it. But the driver circled the city, took many more turns than was necessary, and it was at this point that she grew uneasy. When the cab stopped in front of the house, her husband stepped to the curb first and turned to give his arm to his wife. His face grew ashen as he saw that her mouth was filling with blood, although he had felt nothing. The blood gushed into her cupped hand, and she heard the report of some 25 bullets. This is an approximation. Later, it was revealed that there were over 20 bullet wounds in his neck alone. She was taken to the hospital, where she was treated for 24 hours. Men from the Anticomunista Apostolica visited her there, supposedly to express their condolence. She knew the truth. They wished to establish from her that it had been a clean job. She refused to speak to them. The funeral was to be held the next day. The cortege passed in front of the presidential palace, and a crowd of many thousands hurled insults at the balcony. Isabel Perón ordered that only immediate family would be permitted at the gravesite. She, in her bravery, negotiated with Isabel Perón for hours, finally achieving the admission of 300 mourners to the cemetery. One speech would be permitted. She negotiated with Isabel through her bandaged mouth. It was a political assassination. It would be a political burial. She left the country soon after and is now in Paris. She speaks openly only at this house. She is horribly scarred. Claribel turned away from the window light, her glass tipping in her hand, a few drops of iced rum spilled on the stone floor. I latched the shutters over the window and knelt on the floor beside her. I had another friend. They said to her, "It will be easy for you. We are going to bring one of your friends, and we will ask you questions to which you will answer yes or no." They took her to the Blue Theater. This is the room with many mirrors and lights. They brought the young man whom she had known only as Julio. In some small way, he was able to signal her that she was to say nothing, that she was not to recognize him. When questioned, she said simply, "I do not know him." Then they began to cut pieces from his already mutilated body, forcing her to witness his dismemberment and death. She was hospitalized in a psychiatric ward and is now in, I don't know, I don't remember where she now is. The light through the shutters slatted her face, her eyes were closed. I took the drink from her hand and set it on the floor. Then with the hem of my skirt, I dabbed at the wet stones. "They're waiting for us on the terrace," I told her. "I know. Do you know Camus?" He said, "We resemble one another in what we see together, in what we suffer together, Do you know him? A little. They're waiting. Wouldn't you like to go now? So you wonder why I sit here every afternoon. I wait for the mail. Every afternoon I think some news will come from Salvador. Sometimes letters come, but only rarely is there news. This is why I sit here. So we went to the terrace where Claribel's husband and daughters were already gathered around the iron table to smoke, talk, and have wine. Let's hear a poem, her husband said. One of the poems you worked on today. We're all invited to a party tonight, one of the daughters said. We're going to dress up. Everyone has to think of something to wear. Costumes? And then we're going to the Cala for a night swim. Robert Graves will be 82 next week. We should do something. We can have something here. It went on. We finished one jug of wine and half another. As each wind brought a snowing of almond blossoms from the orchard below us to the baked road, our chairs turned to face the Teche, the mountain that transfixed the village of Deya. That night we would have dry soup or paella and later go to the cafe for 101 brandy or Pernod, the cafe where it was possible to do anything, even make love on the tables, and where two crazed men believed they were each Jesus Christ. This was the summer of 1977, when I went to Deya in order to live with Claribel so that I could translate her poetry into English. Claribel had been in voluntary exile from El Salvador for 23 years then, several of them spent here, on an island in the Baleares chain, where people from Paris or London come to holiday, and where Robert Graves lived. Mama isn't herself today, one of the daughters said, as one of them had said each day I had been in Deya. You shouldn't let her talk so much about the past. She suffers from depression. Maybe it would be better if you just translated the poems and didn't ask her so much about them. Would that be possible? I don't know, I said. I don't think so. The problem is that I don't understand her poems without asking. It was my first attempt at translation. That spring I had worked at Maya's kitchen table in San Diego, wringing the formica and lined paper with coffee as I discarded one version after another. I can't do this using only a dictionary. I don't know enough. Then come to Deya with me for the summer. You can live with us and she'll help you. From Mallorca, I wrote to a friend who had helped me in the past. Long nights in the cafe with cognac and coffee to keep us sober or drunk. I meet them, this procession of writers and painters, one with 14 unpublished novels, a painter who bathes himself each morning in the torrente. In over a decade, he hasn't shown his work. He lives on bread and cheese. Sometimes I wonder what I'm doing here. So in the mornings, I went to the empty cafe while everyone else was asleep and wrote postcards to my parents and friends about what a wonderful time it was, describing the orange, lemon, and olive groves, the goat paths, the cemetery where each grave was marked with a photograph of the deceased. On one card, last night, there was a sirocco. They claimed that these hot, directionless winds drive people to insanity. I lay awake, listening to it. It doesn't know where it's going. No one knows where the sirocco begins. We stayed at the cafe for a while, and Claribel told me about her new novel, which begins in Deya. She is walking on the mule steps and meets a man there. They exchange buenos dias, and she leaves for the tienda to shop. It is not until she arrives home that she recalls that the man on the mule steps had been dead for 3 months, and it goes on like that. We went to Claribel's small finca in the country outside Deya. I have to get away, she had announced that morning. It is as simple as that. At the farm, she stepped from her high-heeled sandals and walked barefoot in the lemon orchard over dead fruit blossoms. The hired man, Bartholomé, went into his stone hut to make coffee for us. He said it would be the campesino way, boiled instead of perked. We drank it under some branches already beginning to dip with hard pears. Barthelme took the empty baskets from the back car seat and returned with oranges, a sack of early beans, dried verbena leaves, and some peaches which were almost white. Barthelme posed for me, joking that in taking his photograph I had become a collector of antiques. Clarivel told me the story of a Mallorquin woman who had seen everything, the war, and who had lost everything, a woman who had been on Franco's side. Her dying wish had been to urinate over a bouquet of gladiolus. It's true, Clarivel had said, amazing. I took 30 photographs of Barthelme in rapid succession as he talked and moved his hands, smoked, poured coffee, reached to the ground for ripe zucchinis. For 25 years I have lived on this mountain, he said, and without it, Barthelme would die. Clarivel watched him and whispered to me that Barthelme knew the subtle distinctions between one plant and another, how their emotions vary, that, for instance, the jasmine do not wish to be transplanted, and so he cries for them as he digs them up. Barthelme was letting millet seed drop from his palm softly into the finch cage, which hung from the veranda of the main house. He was making the noises of a bird with his teeth and tongue. I'm happier here. It is very like El Salvador. Barthelme is like a Salvadoran. Go ahead into the house if you like. Camus is there, and some other books in English. We ate fruit Barthelme hacked open with his machete. So many people were fascist on this part of the island, she said. They tell stupid stories, such as the one about the Republican woman who gave birth to a dead cat. In the house I saw things I would later see in El Salvador, paper flowers and curios, the photograph of a woman with a water jug on her head and a child in each arm, a glass shelf of small clay pre-Columbian figures. I found Resistance, Rebellion, and Death, her Camus, as well as Pasternak in English, the collected poetry of Shelley, and an anthology of Hebrew poems. Clarivel packed these in a basket of lemons. It was time to go back. Take these with you, Barthelme gave me brine olives tied in cheesecloth, and this too, he grinned, but there was nothing more in his hand. Like a Salvadoran campesino, she said in the car, certain things, the odor of jasmine on my terrace, can revive the memory of my country, or perhaps I should say my countries, but all too frequently I feel that words are growing sterile, that I'm reconstructing a memory, the faces of lost friends, the shorthand expressions by which we immediately understand each other without having to launch into detailed explanations. All of these things, I sometimes fear, are fading, becoming more and more difficult to summon up. I'm on a life raft in a placid sea. I have survived the shipwreck, the slow floundering of half a dozen countries, but I look around at times and ask myself, what am I doing here? And the guilt surges up. I am going to explain why I'm here. I wasn't forced into exile. This is important for you to understand because many people are forced. They would rot in cells if they remained in their countries. They would simply disappear. My friend Cortaza doesn't even use the word exile. For him, it has no meaning in the modern world. Maybe he thinks we're all in exile one way or another. It's true that when I wrote Ashes of Izalco, it was viewed as a subversive book. It was a novel, but also a thinly disguised account of the uprising which occurred in my country in 1932. Too thinly disguised. I called it Cenizas de Izalco because of what happened with the volcano. The road was a spiral of thin dirt shelf cut into the mountain. Clarivel was silent in the turns, twisting the several rings she wore. When the trucks too wide for the road had passed us, she explained that the uprising had lasted for 3 days. On the first night, the quiet volcano Izalco erupted, showering San Salvador with glassy brown ash. The days were like night. The peasants killed 43 people, more or less. The crater, it seemed, had burned a hole in the sky. The ash fell, the government forces took the lives of between 20 and 80,000 peasants, depending on one's point of view. By the third day, Most of the lives were lost, and the volcano became quiet. Each night, a torch of lava fire burned on its peak after that, so it became known as the Lighthouse of the Pacific. I was a child then, she said. I was there. What happened then? Nothing has happened in Salvador for 45 years. When we got home, she led me up the narrow steps to her library, where the old family sepias from Salvador hung beside the film noir smoky photographs of writers in Paris. From Thomas Anderson's book, Matanza, she read me this. Like most ghosts, the specter of 1932 prospers best in twilight and shadow. For this reason, the ruling military powers have deliberately tried to keep the true nature of the events of that year from the people. They have fostered a legend of bloodthirsty mobs butchering thousands of middle-class citizens and of a heroic army that barely managed to turn back the barbarian wave. Little has been written on the revolt except propaganda. The National Library has been purged even of newspapers that cover that period. Government files have been conveniently lost, and yet the old order cannot last forever. Someday more serious reformers than the colonels will come along and gain control of the country. When that day comes, El Salvador will be able to reevaluate the events of the 30s. I remember the Guardias Nacionales bringing dozens of prisoners into the fortress across the street from my home, with their thumbs tied behind them with bits of cord, shoving them along with rifle butts. I remember the shots at night. I remember the colonel striking a peasant who had his hands bound behind him, and my father running out of his clinic, his doctor's tunic flapping to shout, "Colonel, a real man doesn't hit anyone who cannot defend himself." I remember the black cloud boiling up behind Santa Ana from the volcano, the people walking along the street of Santa Ana with handkerchiefs over their noses, volcanic ash dropping from the cloud to powder their hair and coat the streets with a gray film. I remember a few weeks later, a peasant woman from Izalco coming to our door to beg for herself and for her children. She shook her head at my mother's question and replied, "There is only a handful of us, Senora. Only a handful left." That night, we built a little pine fire in the same room where each afternoon Claribel sat near the window waiting for the mail. We put thick 78s on the record player, and she tried to teach me to dance the milonga. And then I skip a little and read you the last few pages of this beginning section. The evening occurs, and there is a walk in the cemetery to look at the little photographs. A woman, this is a new day in the afternoon. That afternoon, a young woman visited Condlao, the name given to Claribel's house. She was Argentine, and we'd been born within days of each other. The usual silence was maintained in the house until late day, with Claribel sequestered with the woman, who will be called Lucia, behind the closed bedroom door. Their whispers slid under the door jamb, and when they came out, it was to join us on the terrace at the usual hour. Claribel appeared older without her makeup. She moved her chair close to Lucia and kept her hand lightly on the woman's arm. She has something to tell us about. Lucia lit a cigarette and let the smoke crawl from her mouth, closed her eyes briefly, then leaned forward, hands between her knees. She explained that a poet friend in Barcelona had suggested that she might come to Deia for a rest, and that she could stay at Condlao, where so many of us have stayed, and she smiled appreciatively at each of us. I have just come from Argentina. I worked as a clerk in an office because I am a playwright, and there is no money for plays. It was tedious work, but something, and I shared a small flat with another girl whom I did not know very well. The girl had a fiancé who sometimes stayed with us, sometimes, but only for a few days. He was a student, he said, of agronomy. Agricultural economy, is that how you say it? One day I came home from work and my roommate's things simply were not there. She had left some rent money, but no note. I didn't think anything. A week or so later, the police came for me. They told me that my roommate's boyfriend was with the Tupamaros, so I must be questioned. They wouldn't let me call anyone. I couldn't change clothes. They took me to a police building which wasn't marked on the outside. I waited there in an anteroom, chained to a bench which was bolted to the floor. There was a metal desk and a telephone, filing cabinets, everything for an office. The desk was covered with clipboards and papers, and so I thought everything would be cleared up. And, of course, they would realize the mistake. This was for 3 hours. Men came in and out to answer the phone, but no one touched me. Finally, they unlocked the chain and took me to a cell. My clothes were taken off. The cell was black. It looked as if there had been a fire there. The walls were wet, and whatever had blackened the walls was running in streams to the floor. In the middle of the floor, there was a block of ice about like this. Lucia cut the iron table with her hands into quarters. At first, they questioned me and struck me with their fists. How long have you been with the Tupamaros? Things like that. Then they put me on the block of ice about 3 feet from the wall and made me press my hands against the wall very far apart. I was to stand on the ice until it melted. She turned away from us. It was 5 o'clock. 5 bells fell into the wind, seeming to descend the staircased rooftops of the village. Each time I lifted a foot from the ice, they struck me. I don't know how long I was there, or later, how long I slept in the cold water. Someone came in with my clothes and told me I could go. I had been brought in, it seemed, only for routine questioning. So I'm here. That night, I began to sleep in the room save for Claribel's mother, the woman called Abuelita, who was still in Salvador. It was on the second story with a window facing Africa and the Teche. I remained awake while the moon moved out of the Teche, crossing the village to the water, and this is how I knew Lucia walked the hallways at night, from her room to the bathroom and back, from her room to the terrace. One night, I joined her there, and we leaned for a long time against a wall covered with flowering vines. I'm worried about my memory, she said, because it is too good. I'm going to continue with a few more poems from this section. The first little one, I'm going to read a small poem that takes place in Salvador. The autumn after I came back from Spain, I was visited by Claribel's nephew from Salvador. And I had heard about him in Spain, and I had heard a lot of crazy things and legends and such, and I really didn't know what to think, but he was Claribel's nephew. And one day, I was working for Amnesty International, and I had my table all covered with papers and things, and I heard a truck in my driveway, and I went out, and there was a Toyota Hiace in my driveway, which is a Japanese truck van that's made for export to Latin America and Africa. It was white and covered with dust and had El Salvador plates. And a man got out with 2 little girls, and he had a big white roll of shelf paper or butcher paper under his arm and about 20 pencils. And he came up to me and he said, "You are Carolyn Forche, and I am Leonel Gomez Vives." And I was a little bit afraid because I really didn't know whether he was who he said he was or not, but he had 2 little girls with him, so I thought, well, he can't be too bad. And the little girls looked very nice, but I ran in the house and I got snapshots I had taken in Spain. And I said, "If you are Claribel's nephew, I want you to tell me every single person's name in these photographs. Whose baby is this? Whose husband is that? Whose wife is this?" So he did it all, and he was laughing, and finally he said, "That's a pretty good trick," and he liked it. And I said, "Well, you can come in." And he looked at all of my things on the table and he said, "Clear the table. We have work to do." So I cleared the table and he said, "Make a big pot of coffee." So I made that. And he covered the table with the white paper. And then he sat down. 72 cups of coffee later, 72 hours later without sleeping. Every time I said, do you think you want to sleep for a little while? He would say, we don't have that much time. I only have 3 days. I have a lot to tell you. He covered the paper with little drawings of people and of villages and of planes and of helicopters and all kinds of things like that, and diagrams and charts of the internal structures of the Salvadoran military, of the economic structures of the country and the coffee-growing families of the American embassy and such. And he talked and talked and talked, and he said to me, the security forces in my country have murdered 2 priests and exiled, tortured, or imprisoned 40 nuns and killed 300 campesinos, peasants, in the last 11 months. And then he produced 2 documents from my own House of Representatives about fraudulency in the election and the religious persecution. This was 1977. And he said, you have a Guggenheim. And that means that you have 1 year to do whatever you want, as I had explained to him. And my friends had all said, go to Paris and write poetry, or at least New England. And so this was what I was planning. And he said, why don't you come to El Salvador? And I will pass you among my friends and hand to hand, and you can work with women doctors, and mostly women, he said. And we will spend a year there, and you can learn about El Salvador. And he said, because in 3 to 5 years, my country is the beginning of your country's next Vietnam. And we would like to educate an American writer, so that when the time comes, you can speak and write, if you wish, in the United States. But please understand, there are no strings, and you don't have to write if you don't want, and we won't tell you what to think and how to view the situation. And if you get scared or bored or tired, then you can just get on a plane to the United States, and no hard feelings, and everything will be fine. But he said, as long as you stay there, it's a very dangerous situation, so please listen to us and follow our advice and have the experiences that we present for you. And if you don't want to do it, then it's better if you go home, because it's very easy to have something go wrong here. He said, you can be a journalist. And I said, I'm a poet. That's very different. I'm not a journalist. He said, it's the same thing. And I said, no, it isn't. And we fought like that. He says, it's better if you are a journalist. So I said, can I just say I'm a journalist without really being one? And he said, yes. Of course, later he changed his mind. He said, now you have to write something because you have told everybody that you are a journalist. And so that's how I became a journalist, but by trying to cover myself, more or less. But also because it became very clear to me after I got there that it was important to document what was happening. And I, at that time, of course, did not dream of having any of Salvadoran poetry. It didn't occur to me that that would be the logical way to document things. Well, I'm going to tell you about one experience and then read a small poem that came of it. At one point in Salvador, I had been working for Amnesty International, communicating with them under the name Lucia, and sending information out of the country. And so I kept asking my friends to tell me about the political prisoners. What are their names, and how can I want to document where they disappeared, and I want to send all of this information, and we can help them. And my friend said, you can't see anything where political prisoners are kept. Most of the political prisoners are killed. Anyone who sees where they're sequestered doesn't live to tell about it. We can't help you, take our word for it. Think about the larger picture. And I was unhappy with that, and finally one day they said, we have arranged for you to go into a prison. It's not a political prison, it's a criminal penitentiary, but there are political prisoners there. And they said, we've arranged this through a friend of a friend of a friend, and no one will question you because you will walk in officially looking very American, and you'll have 30 minutes inside, and we want you to try to see something. And we give you 80% chance everything will be okay. So I thought, 80? And then I was thinking about the other 20. And then I realized, of course, I was going in or I was going to go home, according to the pact that I had made with myself and with them. So I went in. It was Ahuachapán prison, at the present time an army cuartel. At that time, there were 400 men in the space for 200.
The National Guard was guarding the prison. There was about 17 of them, all about 17 years old, with their helmets too big for them, and very young, and with G3 automatic weapons. And when I went inside, I was introduced to a very gentle man who had his leg green and swollen from phlebitis and was dragging it on a stick, and I was to be ostensibly visiting him. So he pretended to know me and, oh yes, so nice to see you again. And he took me slowly around the prison and showed me where they sleep and where they eat and all of that. There were buckets for excrement and urine beside what passed for water and food altogether, no sanitation. Incredible. He had purchased for me an orange crush out of a soda machine at the guard station and opened it and handed it to me. And I didn't want it, but he said, you take it, and inside the prison, he said, that is what you should smell so you won't pass out. So I did that, and we walked around, and he showed me everything. And then when the guards were busy with something that looked like a crap game, craps with a dice, and they weren't paying attention to me anymore because I had become boring, he showed me a dark open doorway, and he said, why don't you just walk through that doorway for a minute? And he said, just be an absent-minded North American lady. And he made an absent-minded North American lady face for me. And he said, go for 1 minute, try to see, control your face when you come out. You didn't see anything. So I went in, and inside the room, there were wooden boxes, each about a meter by a meter by a meter, like the size of a small washing machine. Each was padlocked. Each had openings the size of a hardcover book with chicken wire mesh over the openings. As I adjusted to the darkness, I counted the boxes. They were one on top of the other and three across, six in all. And I tried to determine which wall they were against. And then I counted the seconds. And then I controlled myself and I walked out. And he told me I had hives on my neck, and so I should tie my sweater sleeves around my neck to hide them. And then he said, that's called la oscura, the darkness. Solitary. Sometimes men are kept in there 1 year and can't move when they come out because of the atrophy in their muscles. So I left. I had to leave the prison. The friend I had made in that half hour had been in there for many years for political reasons. He had married when he was about 7 years earlier than when I met him. And marriage had never been consummated. It was legally done while he was in prison. So this is a poem I wrote when I left for him, the visitor. In Spanish, he whispers, there is no time left. It is the sound of scythes arcing in wheat, the ache of some field song in Salvador, the wind along the prison, cautious, as Francisco's hands on the inside touching the walls as he walks. It is his wife's breath slipping into his cell each night while he imagines his hand to be hers. It is a small country. There is nothing one man will not do to another. The following is a documentary poem. The Colonel, what you have heard is true. I was in his house. His daughter filed her nails. His son went out for the night. There were daily papers, pet dogs, a pistol on the cushion beside him. The moon swung on its black cord over the house. On the television was a cop show. It was in English. Broken bottles were embedded in the walls around the house to scoop the kneecaps from a man's legs or cut his hands to lace. On the windows, there were gratings like those in liquor stores. We had dinner, rack of lamb, good wine. A gold bell was on the table for calling the maid. The maid brought green mangoes, salt, a type of bread. I was asked how I enjoyed the country. There was a brief commercial in Spanish. His wife took everything away. There was some talk then of how difficult it had become to govern. The parrot said hello on the terrace. The colonel told it to shut up and pushed himself from the table. My friend said to me with his eyes, "Say nothing." The colonel returned with a sack used to bring groceries home. He spilled many human ears on the table. They were like dried peach halves. There is no other way to say this. He took one of them in his hands, shook it in our faces, dropped it into a water glass. It came alive there. "I am tired of fooling around," he said. "As for the rights of anyone, tell your people they can go fuck themselves." He swept the ears to the floor with his arm and held the last of his wine in the air. "Something for your poetry, no?" he said. Some of the ears on the floor caught this scrap of his voice. Some of the ears on the floor were pressed to the ground. San Salvador, May 1978. The last in this section is a little elegy for a friend of mine who was killed in El Salvador in January 1981 while he had been asked to have dinner with the American labor advisors, Michael Hammer and Mark Perlman, because he was the leader of a very large and nonviolent campesino organization that had been founded in the early 60s. And it had cooperative farms. And the night after he completed dinner with the Americans, a right-wing death squad came into the hotel and shot the three of them. And when it was reported in the papers, his name wasn't mentioned. It was only, you know, Michael Hammer, Mark Perlman, and a Salvadoran man. And I knew him fairly well, and I liked him very much, and I wanted his name to be mentioned somewhere, so I put it in this elegy as a dedication. Because one is always forgotten, in memoriam, Jose Rudolfo Vieira. When Vieira was buried, we knew it had come to an end. His coffin rocking into the ground like a boat or a cradle. "I could take my heart," he said, "and give it to a campesino. And he would cut it up and give it back. You can't eat heart in those four dark chambers where a man can be kept years. A boy soldier in the bone hot sun works his knife to peel the face from a dead man and hang it from the branch of a tree flowering with such faces. The heart is the toughest part of the body. Tenderness is in the hands." I'm going to read a poem to bring you up about something else. I have this grandmother who comes in once a book. She used to stand, now she stands over my shoulder often, but she used to stand over it, you know, when I was a child. She died in 1968. Her name was Anna, and she was from Czechoslovakia, and she was very bossy and very domineering. I'm the oldest of seven children, and my mother is not Slovak. My mother is, as my mother says, an American. And they used to fight, because Anna thought that my mother couldn't keep house, which was true. And my mother thought that my grandmother told too many stories to us that mostly weren't true about things like the old country and sex. And we were told not to believe anything that Anna said. But as it happened, most of what she told us happened to be true. It was just things my mother didn't want us to know at that age. Now, Anna had a peculiar way of speaking English. She didn't speak it very well. I had to be the little peace bridge. Children soak up languages like sponges. So I would do Slovak with her and English with my mother and back and forth and try to make the peace all the time. And Anna called, for instance, a colander a macaroni stop, water go ahead. And she called me piscata, which is slang for chatterbox. It's actually Polish slang. She spoke a My father called it a smorgasbord of languages. And she was wonderful. And one of the things that she said, she used to say things like, "This country is a piece of shit." And my mother would say, "Well, if you want to go back to the old country, we can arrange it," like that. One time, Anna said to me, "In the old country, there are no weeds in the woods. Not like you have here. All this junk between the trees," she said. "Just a nice carpet of grass between the trees. No weeds." So my mother said she's lying again. But this stuck with me, as things will stick in our lives. I went to the Conference of Non-Aligned Nations in Belgrade, Yugoslavia, 1978, and afterwards wanted to go on a little vacation. There's a village called Slatizbor, which looks like a little Swiss village in Serbia. And I was on the train. It was very hot. And the train was, I was had my head against the glass, and I was almost sick, and I wanted to be off. You know the kind of train that is. And so we went into the woods, and I looked out at the window, and I stood up in the aisle, and I shouted, "There are no weeds in the woods!" And I was pounding on my friend's shoulders, and all of the Yugoslavs were looking at me like, "This Amerikanska's too hot." But I tried to explain, you know, a little bit of Serbian, a little bit of French, a little bit of English, why this was so important. There were sheep grazing in the woods, as there are sheep grazing everywhere, and they bite everything away, and it was the nice carpet of grass. So this is a poem about going to Yugoslavia and discovering that my grandmother was not unique. In fact, she was a dime a dozen. Endurance. In Belgrade, the windows of the tourist hotel opened over seven stories of lilacs. Rain clearing sidewalk tables of linens and liquor. The silk flags of the non-aligned nations like colorful underthings pinned to the wind, Tito was living. I bought English, was mistaken for Czech, walked to the fountains, the market of garlic and tents, where I saw my dead Anna again and again, hard yellow beans in her lap, her babushka of white summer cotton, her eyes the hard pits of her past. She was gossiping among her friends, saying the rosary or trying to sell me something. Anna, peeling her hands with a paring knife, saying, "In your country you have nothing." Each word was the husk of a vegetable tossed to the street, or a mountain rounded by trains with cargoes of sheep dung and grief. I searched in Belgrade for some holy face painted without hands, as when an icon painter goes to sleep and awakens with an image come from the dead. On each corner, Anna dropped her work in her lap and looked up. "I am a childless poet," I said. "I have not painted an egg, made prayers, or finished my Easter duty in years. I left Belgrade for Frankfurt last summer, Frankfurt for New York. New York for the Roanoke Valley, where mountains hold the breath of the dead between them and lift from each morning a fresh bandage of mist. New York, Roanoke, the valley. To this cape where in the dunes the wind takes a body of its own and a fir tree comes to the window at night, tapping on the glass like a woman who has lived too much. Piscata, hold your tongue," she says. "I'm trying to tell you something." Thank you. Is it enough time? Is it okay? It's long, huh?